Welcome back to Slut PhD. I am your host, Julie Fennell, and today's episode is about the overlap between neurodivergence and kink and polyamory. Not about the overlap between kink and polyamory, which is its own topic that's kind of fun and interesting, and maybe I'll do that in a future episode. I should warn you that my cat has been relentless in demanding my affection, so you might hear him purring in the background if you follow me on the internet. He features heavily on my Instagram stories. His name is Rufio. He has decided that he wants to be part of this podcast episode, so that's just a thing that's going to happen. I also want to warn you at the start of this episode, which, by the way, was by request back from when I was originally starting to form this podcast, that I'm a little out of my area of expertise here. I am a sociologist, not a psychologist. I will hopefully be returning to some of these themes later on. Eventually, I'm going to do an episode on queer mental health, which is something that I've been studying for the better part of over a year now, almost. And I'm indirectly researching a lot of the things that I'll be talking about in this podcast for that work on queer mental health. But I don't know hardly anything about the technical mental health aspects as a psychologist would about things like ADHD or autism. I know about it way more from a, hey, what do people think they know about this perspective as a sociologist and also kind of a collective mental health experience, which is not the same thing. This episode is going to be full of lots of other people's research that I'm going to hazily throw out mention of, and I probably won't get around to actually putting citations in the episode notes because I'm very busy right now. And I am, of course, surrounded by people who are like the kinds of people I'm going to be talking about in this podcast. So I get plenty of opportunities to look around the world and see things. I've been so much conversation in the last few years about the overlap between kink and neurodivergence. When my book, Please Scream Quietly, came out in 2022, I had a number of people asking me, like, oh, do you talk about the kink neurodivergent overlap? And I said, no, I'm sorry. My research, my interviews were from 2012, and then my survey data was from 2017, and all of that really predated our community. I would say conversation, but it's really more of an obsession these days with neurodivergence. And so I don't have any actual data on that. And I really hope that somebody does get around to collecting that. I think somebody's tried, but you need pretty big sample sizes in order to get meaningful data. And it's getting increasingly hard to come by. I do have some data on queers in general, which I'm hopefully going to be publishing in the not terribly distant future, presenting at the conference in April of 2025. But it's really complicated for a number of reasons here. First of all, because the term neurodivergent is a little vague. I'll get there in a second. But the term kinky is extremely vague, right? So deciding who counts as kinky, about 50% of people at least say they have BDSM fantasies. If all of those people count as kinky, then I don't think that the kink neurodivergent overlap is going to be very high. But of course, kinky is kind of a spectrum, and so is neurodivergent. And I suspect strongly that if we could somehow make that spectrum laid out in front of us, that we would find some pretty decent correlations between neurodivergent and very kinky, very, very kinky. Certainly the kinds of people who show up in the BDSM subculture, but that's its own kind of thing, right? Like the people who are willing to come do BDSM in front of other people in a public way, socialize about it, like they're a different group of people than the people who just want to, tie up their partner in the bedroom. The neurodivergent polyamory overlap is much less ambiguous because polyamory is much less ambiguous. Ethical non-monogamy as a category is more ambiguous because it's very broad. But if we look specifically narrowly at polyamory, I can tell you that there aren't that many people who do polyamory. I have recently had to fight with somebody. I was the reviewer on a paper and someone kept trying to assert that polyamory was common. And I was like, what on earth? is the basis of your claim that polyamory is common. And they cite a statistic, and they gave numbers instead of percentages. So I went and plugged the math for them. I said, by your math, 0.05% of American adults are polyamorous. That hardly constitutes common. So, it's handy using polyamory here because it has got a much more specific definition than kinky does. And it is also, measurably uncommon. However, I think understanding why there seems to be an overlap, pretty serious overlap, between neurodivergence and polyamory is much more difficult. It doesn't have an intuitive explanation the way that I can construct and will construct in this episode, more of an intuitive overlap between kink and neurodivergence. Particularly useful thing about trying to deconstruct the overlap between polyamory and neurodivergence is that presumably there aren't that many people who are secretly polyamorous at home, and there's plenty of people who are secretly having threesomes, again, back to the ethically non-monogamous, but very few people who are secretly polyamorous. And so we get to sort of see that in a way that we don't with BDSM. The general assumption that persists is that autistic people are practically by definition much more willing to challenge social norms than neurotypical people. And so that feeds into to some of that in terms of understanding where polyamory comes from there. I know for myself that feels inadequate as an explanation. I know I've talked on this podcast before, my episode on sexual identity, that I feel like I was polyamorous from the beginning, from as long as I could think. No one handed me the idea. I was like a 5-year-old, and I was just like, oh, yeah, like this monogamy thing looks really stupid. I don't know why anyone would want to do that. And I don't think I would ever do that. And sure, I mean, I guess autistic children can be challenging social norms, but I don't feel like I was a kid who was particularly challenging social norms in general. In fact, I suppose probably again, like many autistic children, I was a pretty avid rule follower, even more than my parents expected me to be. And so that's hard for me to construct. But maybe this is all part and parcel of the same thing. I don't know. I, however, personally don't think that that's what's going on there. Do I have data to back that up? No. Do I have instinct? Yes. Do I have a lot of observations? Yes. So, as we try to unpack the meaning of neurodivergence, there's been a growing literature on this term neuroqueer, which is its own concept, really, basically arguing that we shouldn't seek out neurotypicality, or that neurotypicality is made out to be better than it really is. But the big thing to take away from, I think, some of this literature from a sociological perspective is that there's more and more reasons to believe that queer people are just different, both in terms of bodies and in terms of mind. So I believe in a previous episode on gender that I mentioned before that multiple cross-cultural studies have found that feminine assigned male at birth children lisp. So, to put that more simply, even problematically in terms of language, like feminine boys, many of whom will grow up to be gay, some of whom will grow up to be trans. I think probably statistically most of them grow up to be gay. Will lisp, which isn't even something that women in those cultures do. So it's not that they're imitating a feminine behavior that they've witnessed. It's just something that they do. And this is true in languages that are not English. Again, these are multicultural studies. And in fact, the best study that I found on this was done in the Netherlands. So I was looking at kids speaking Dutch. And we just know from a number of studies like that, I think, that there's something complicated and weird going on with being queer that we don't really get. Like, what on earth? How could there, is there a gene that makes you lisp? I don't know. Apparently, it only applies to assigned male at birth people. Same studies did not find any speech idiosyncrasies for masculine girls. And there's no documentation of like masculine women having an idiosyncratic speech pattern, but there is for feminine men. And this is just part and parcel, I think, of a long set of patterns that suggest that queer people are different in ways that we really don't understand. I think personally that when it comes to the polyamory and neurodivergence overlap, my inclination is to say that polyamory is just a subset of queer, especially if you're like me and you feel like you were born that way, as opposed to people who learned to be polyamorous. But if you feel like you're a born this way type of poly, I think at that point you're definitely queer, even if you are straight in terms of your sexual orientation. I think that's where that overlap occurs. And I think the other part of the overlap is just socialization, right? People get taught to be polyamorous. So there's two clearly different groups of poly people in that respect, of people who can't imagine ever not being poly, and people who are like, I could be poly or not. And I see people coming up with different terms for that, of in terms of like, you know, poly or monoflexible or something like that. And then there's people who are just like, yeah, I'm poly now. I can't imagine ever not being poly again, but I, you know, came to this by way of friends and socialization. And I think that the people who are born this way, polys, in my experience, tend to be a bit further along on the spectrum, autistically speaking. And I think actually in my experience and observation, a lot more of the people who are like, well, I wasn't born this way, I got taught to be it, but I can't imagine ever being anything else, they often are ADHD. And I think for people who are ADHD like that, having multiple partners just is helpful because it helps them stay interested, right? It helps increase novelty and stimulation, and it helps them stay involved in their relationships in a way that they might struggle with if they were monogamous. If we break down the term neurodivergent and ask what does that really mean, we see that it's been expanding a lot, for better and for worse, in terms of what it encompasses. But increasingly, I'm hearing more and more people say that, you know, it's really about the idea that your neurons are different, that you are wired differently in your body and in your mind. And we should stop actually using the sentence like in your body and in your mind and just say in your body. Because I think, as I'm going to hint at from some of the research that I've been doing, that there just isn't a difference between those things, the way that we've been taught in America, at least, to believe that there is. These are really just the same thing. For me personally, that idea that neurodivergent was about neurons was really brought home for me last year when I went to two different doctors in the space of, I don't know, like 6 weeks or so. And the first one, I had had an IUD for a long time, and it had started giving me pretty serious problems. And I orgasm a lot from my cervix, which a lot of doctors have tried to tell me that that's not a thing, but they're full of shit. And I looked at the survey data, and about 10% of women do. 10% is not nothing. It's actually a pretty substantial percentage of people. I don't know why they keep trying to erase my experience. I fortunately have a really good doctor now who's very sympathetic about it. So I've had to have an IUD because I have endometrial precancer. But it was giving me a lot of trouble. And I could tell that my depression that I had been experiencing at that point for like 2 months or so was chemical, that it wasn't from me, that it wasn't about my circumstances. And so I assumed reasonably that it was from the hormones in the IUD. And but I had stopped being able to feel the strain of my IUD. And so I went to the doctor and she said, hey, can I just try to manipulate that for you and see if I can help? And I was like, of course. So she pulls the string out from behind my cervix and gets it back into place. And I had the truly outrageous experience of going from being pretty depressed to being not depressed in 20 minutes. So like on a 5-point scale of mood, I bumped up like 2 places in the space of 20 minutes. Which was fucking surreal. But on top of that, while she was talking to me through this, it was clear that she expected that I couldn't feel anything that she was doing. And when she was done, I was like, so was I not supposed to be able to feel any of that? And she was like, no, you're not supposed to be able to feel that at all. Like other people wouldn't. And I was like, I'm not in a lot of pain, but I'm at like headache levels. Like I'm going to have to go home and take an Advil She was just like, wow, you are wired so differently. And then on top of that experience, of course, you know, subsequently I had this huge boost in mood that was absolutely bizarre that and lasted. It wasn't temporary at all. And so it was clear to me that just having the string pressing down on my cervix had a really major impact on my mental health. Which, if you're listening to that and going, that sounds insane, believe me, I think so too, but here I am. And then just a few weeks later, I went to a different doctor to have a very minor surgery done to try to minimize ingrown toenails. So you have to like numb your toe in preparation for this. And the doctor goes to do the thing. She shoots me up with the numbing agent. And then after this first round of it, she says, okay, so I need to poke at you for a second because a small percentage of people have this nerve crossed over here. So I need to make sure that you don't and that I don't need to give you another shot. She goes, poke, poke, poke. And I go, ow. She says, ah, yes, you are one of those people. Okay, well, we will give you another shot. And she did. But it was just yet another confirmation in a fairly short period of time that my body is weird and different. And I think that's really important to keep in mind as we try to understand more about what might make us as kinky and or poly people in terms of our own normalcy in our brain. If our bodies are weird, then probably the way that we interact with the rest of the world is going to be a little weird too. You know, when it comes to the kink neurodivergent overlap, the easiest one to understand for that one is always masochist, right? Which I identify as a sort of, I call myself jokingly a true masochist, but I think possibly what that really is just a biological masochist, right? I think that the pain pleasure wires in my brain are crossed, and the pain pleasure centers in your brain are like right up against one another. They're very close. And so it's really easy for those wires to get messy. But I think for many people like me who are and feel like they always have been masochist, you know, it's probably that you're wired up funny. And, you know, I've played with people who could orgasm from being hit. And by people, I think all of them were AFABs, which is another point of great interest for me in all of this is kind of how biological sex versus gender comes into all of this. But I think it's very interesting to see the way that people register pain and pleasure differently. And, you know, if you've got these wires all funny in your brain, then that might make you more likely to be neurodivergent, or pretty much by definition. Another thing that I think is super important to keep in mind when we're talking about how much the brain and the body aren't different is the increasing connections that we are learning about between gastrointestinal issues and other mental issues, right? So, I mean, they're calling this the gut-brain axis for now. But, you know, we found pretty clear connections, especially in children, between autism, ADHD, depression, anxiety, and gastrointestinal issues. And in one of my favorite studies, you know, they actually showed that for anxiety, that relationship is bidirectional, which is to say that being anxious will make your stomach upset, and having your stomach upset will make you anxious. But there's this complicated bidirectional process of aggravation and or soothing going on there. And, you know, it just, I think, is a real problem if we try to separate brain from body stuff, that they are far more entangled than we think. And, you know, it's almost a joke when I hang out in queer circles about how sensitive our stomachs all are, right? Everyone's allergic to 16 different foods. Our bodies are just made kind of funny over here. Another point of connection there that I have found over and over again as somebody who does a ton of rope is that such a high percentage of rope people, especially rope bottoms, are seriously hypermobile, that at this point I can just casually diagnose Ehlers-Danlos syndromes, EDS. If you're unfamiliar with it, I recommend that you go look it up, because there's a decent chance, if you're listening to this podcast, that you have it. And people from just a moment's exchange. So one of the saddest and but also kind of funny, at least abstract moments of this was I was chatting with an acquaintance, a friendly acquaintance of mine who had tied with a couple times. We didn't know each other especially well. I was getting ready to tie her again, and then she just casually mentioned that she's this problem with her appendix, and she hadn't had it out yet. She'd just been too busy, basically. Like she'd gone to, she'd sought medical treatment for it. For whatever reason, they hadn't removed it, and then she needed to go back and have it removed, but she hadn't gotten around to it yet. But and certain she couldn't do certain torsions because her appendix was messed up. And me and my partner were just staring at her like we really couldn't believe that someone was just casually ignoring and had been for months this pain in their appendix. And without any further exchange, I just go, "Hey, can you touch your thumb to your wrist if it's bent, forward?" And she's like, "Yeah, sure, no problem." And I was like, "Ah, yeah, so you have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and you have an associated condition which is called alexithymia, which means that you have basically just learned to distance yourself from your body's pain because you're always in pain and you don't know it." And I proceeded to have her do the other test for EDS, which I believe she passed with flying colors. I refer EDS as the touch your thumb to your wrist disease. But it's extremely common among the kinky queers that I know, and mostly among the kinky queer AFABs. But even my cis straight male husband has it, which confused his doctors because they'd never met a man with it before. But I was like, husband, you do have a gay identical twin. So, if this is in the genes for the queers, then you got that one. So I don't pretend to understand why there would be a reason for people with a collagen deficiency would be so into rope, except that some folks who looked into this in England found that there was an extremely high correlation between EDS and autism in one direction, which is to say, if you have EDS, chances are you have autism. It doesn't work the other way. If you have autism, it doesn't mean you have EDS. But I think, as I'll get to in just a moment, I think autistic people are often very attracted to rope for a variety of reasons. It's also worth noting that both EDS and autism are spectrum disorders, and I tend to think from my observations of the people around me that sort of like the more EDS you have, the more autism you have. But, that's from looking at the world around me. At this point, pretty much anybody who shows up to be tied by me, I just sort of subject them to various tests for EDS and hypermobility because I can practically guarantee that they have these issues. But I'd like to take a little moment and an aside there to think about the interactions between rope and trauma, which are also extremely related to autism, but no one knows in which direction. So, and obviously other mental health issues as well, and ADHD, right? Trauma and ADHD are also extremely related to one another. So it's not really entirely clear how that works out in practice. So I want to alert you to a passage in The Body Keeps the Score that I think is really profound for trying to capture some of what it is that rope bottoms in particular get who are traumatized, who have trauma, get out of rope bottoming. I'm looking at the Kindle edition, but it tells me that it's page 398. I'm 55% of the way through the book. I'm in the chapter that's on yoga. And in that chapter, he talks about how if you are doing yoga, that it helps you to notice things in your body and to anticipate the end of discomfort and strengthen your capacity to deal with physical and emotional distress. It's basically like a challenge exercise that forces you to become more in touch with your body. And I think that there's a huge thing that many people get out of rope bottoming, whether consciously or unconsciously, is having somebody push them to be simultaneously in their body and out of it, to be more in touch with their body while at the same time being in pain, right? It's a whole process that allows you to interact with your mind-body system in a really healthy and helpful way. And I think that for people with trauma, that rope bottoming can be incredibly therapeutic frequently. I know for myself, it's extremely therapeutic to be tied, and I have desperately sought anything else that comes close because I fear the day when my body gives up on me and I can no longer be a rope bottom. And I really want to make sure that I have a substitute experience, and I haven't found one yet. I'm thinking I may have to go to aerial yoga in order to get something close, but I guess it's going to depend on how my body eventually falls apart. However, I know that I have been to rope events in other parts of the world. I've seen interviews with people who are rope people who are speaking a language I don't know, and I'm watching them and I'm just like, oh yeah, that's a rope person. I would know them anywhere. And, you know, part of it is because that both whether they're tying or they're being tied, they just tend to be autistic as fuck. And I include myself in this, right? Like, we're just super neurodivergent, and I don't entirely understand why that would be. I have a lot of theories, though. So, you know, when you see some of the numbers, right, autistic people often really love weighted blankets, which ironically I hate, but they love weighted blankets. And I think it's the feeling of being contained that is comforting to a lot of people about being tied, who are people who are on the spectrum about being tied. And then when it comes to people who are doing the tying, I think that, first of all, I don't think there's anywhere in the world where being a rope top will make you rich. I don't even know if it'll make you famous. It definitely won't make you rich. And it requires a huge devotion of time and a lot of attention to detail. And, you know, if you're talking about something that requires a lot of time in order to get good at and a lot of attention to detail with very little financial incentive behind it, that's the kind of thing that people who are on the spectrum tend to be attracted to. And so I think that's a huge part of why neurodivergent people are attracted to rope topping. And then I think people are also on both sides attracted to rope because it allows them to engage in intimate interactions with somebody else without having to have much eye contact. And also, it allows you to have a long form interaction with someone without having to go through a lot of awkward social conventions. I know every time someone reaches out to me about doing rope, they're like, hey, could we get some coffee or something? And then maybe talk about tying. And I'm just like, could we skip the coffee? I don't like coffee. I don't like the social conventions of having coffee. Rope is my coffee. I'm way more interesting when there's rope involved. And I think a lot of rope people are like that, where it's a way to move past traditional social conventions and interact in a way that feels, intimate, but not too intimate. I will also say, in reference to the body keeps the score, sort of an aside here, that I think based on that information, bad experiences are more likely to be encoded as traumatic memories if you felt helpless at the time, especially physically helpless. But, you know, I think that bad things happen to people when they're in rope, when they're tied up. I think those bad things are more likely to be encoded as traumatic memories. And so, and oftentimes the people who showed up to be tied up in the first place were more traumatized. It was part of what made them attracted to rope. Part of what made us more attracted to rope. And if bad things happen to you when you're tied up and helpless, then I think it seems from the science more likely to be encoded as a traumatic memory. And so it's a risk that we don't often talk to people about. If we talk about the link between kink and neurodivergence more generally, and not just talking about rope, you know, I think one of the reasons why kink is so attractive to people with ADHD is because it keeps intimate interactions novel and stimulating, as I mentioned with regards to polyamory. also relevant for kink as well. I like to joke, you know, kink, it's an activity for horny people who get bored easily. It makes it a lot easier to keep things novel and stimulating and interesting. And it gives people an opportunity to constantly experiment with new sensations. It also can take you out of your brain. You know, people often say about kink that it helps them relax, that it makes their brain shut up, right? And especially for people with ADHD, that's a thing. And a way that sex usually is insufficient to accomplish, or if anything, for some people, sex alone makes that worse, right? So it makes the type, I call them the brain weasels, the little voices in your head that just won't shut the fuck up. It can make the brain weasels worse for some people, having quote unquote normal sex, whereas kink can really force you to pay attention. And meanwhile, I've heard a lot of people say that they think they're part of the reason why people with autism are drawn to kink, especially to DS, because it gives them clear rules for interacting. And it allows you to arrange things so that you can avoid very specific issues or things that you just don't like about the way conventional encounters traditionally happen. So, like, I know for myself, a huge part of why I love DS is because I hate asking for things sexually. I don't find it very hot. And if I'm domming or if I'm subbing, I can just get around that. If I'm domming, I just tell somebody what to do. And if I'm subbing, I get told what to do. But either way, I don't have to ask. And I appreciate the fact that I can arrange things to make that be possible in kink in a way that is very hard to do in a more traditional setting. And then I think people are drawn to masochism because of weird pain pleasure processing. It's a lot harder, actually, to break down the sadism thing. I'll try to remember to put a link in the episode notes to one of my favorite articles on that called Pro-Social Sadism, where someone was trying to help differentiate between the types of people who like engaging in kinky sadism versus the types of people who like to engage in, well, the psychologically, sociologically problematic forms of sadism, right? Where you're torturing people against their will. And, you know, I believe in that article, they find that there is, in fact, a small overlap between those two groups, which is backed up by my experience in kink communities. But I think that one is harder to break down. Right? Why neurodivergent people would come to like to hurt other people, and how that is or is not related to liking to be hurt. I have fewer theories on that one, and it remains a source of a little bit of confusion for me. As I analyze all of this, I can clearly see the overlap in my social world, but I don't have any explanations for it. So I want to conclude this episode by going down, I said in my episode notes, a brief rabbit hole, but the reality is it's probably going to be a somewhat lengthy one, about aphantasia, which was also by request from someone. So aphantasia is not explicitly in and of itself neurodivergent. I guess it is. So aphantasia refers to a condition or experience where people have very limited visual recall or ability to visualize. And so the reason why I am so interested in this is because I and several of my intimate partners have aphantasia. And it is highly correlated with autism and high IQ. But it was only named pretty recently, and you can find a lot of this information on Wikipedia. I'll try to put a link to that in as well. But even though aphantasia is named and primarily researched with reference to having limited visual memory and recall, there has been some research on it that suggests that many people with aphantasia, like me, not only have limited visual memory and recall, but also have extremely limited sense memory and recall in general. So the test that I love that was designed for aphantasia to prove that it wasn't just what people thought was happening in their own heads where they shine a light in people's eyes and to see how much their pupils dilated. They found, no difference between people who said they had aphantasia and people who said they didn't. And also, I should add, aphantasia is a spectrum, like so many of the things that we're talking about here, right? So there are people who can see nothing at all in their heads, and then there's people like me where it's just kind of like a vague blur of shapes and some concepts. And then, obviously, I believe there's also even a condition that's like the other end of the spectrum where people like hyper can visualize everything, which is pretty fucking interesting. It means in my case that like, for example, rotating a 3D object in my head is practically impossible. Anyway, so the test that they designed was to ask these people who they'd shine the lights in their eyes, and everyone's pupils dilated the same when they shine the light, to imagine it's either a sunrise or a sunset, doesn't matter, it's the same thing. And they found that the people who didn't have aphantasia, their pupils would dilate slightly as they imagined the sunrise. And then they found that the people who did have aphantasia, their pupils would not dilate, although there was again a range, and that range matched approximately what the people said their own experiences of aphantasia were, which was a fun way to prove that like aphantasia is real, which it's very hard to do. Because how do you prove what's going on in your own head? However, for me, and I think for several other people I've talked to who have it, I should add, a lot of the research on this, like the samples are pretty small. And so the fact that I have so many people in my life with aphantasia often means that like me just chatting with like people around me is like half the size of the scientific sample. But anyway, we have very limited sense recall. Right. And so I cannot remember what things smell like. I can't remember what things taste like. I can't remember what they look like. I do actually have some slightly better sound recall, but mostly I have a jukebox brain, which is related, but not quite the same. That said, I, have no difficulty with recognition. So, like, I immediately know who someone is when I see them. If they change enough about, if they like change their hair color a lot of times, then I might start to struggle to recognize them. If they change a dramatic feature on themselves, then I will have more difficulty, because in my head, basically, people are sort of stick figures with hair. But in general, like if I taste a food even that I haven't tasted in years, I can fairly confidently be like, oh yeah, that tastes exactly like the way it used to, or that's different. Like that restaurant changed how they used to cook that. And I'll even ask people around me, like, hey, is that true for you too? And they'll say yes or no. But I for me, I feel like it has a huge impact on my relationship with sex because I will remember that sex feels good, but I have absolutely no ability to recall what that feeling good feels like in my own body. And I joke, but I'm not entirely sure that it's a joke. This is part of why I'm such a slut, because I'm like, oh yeah, I know sex feels great, but I can't recall in my body the way that sex feels. But apparently lots of people can do that, and I'm very jealous about them. However, I do think that related to my aphantasia is what I refer to as photographic memory for emotions, which is a really awkward way to describe that. But what I mean by that is I can very clearly recall how I felt in a situation in a deep way. And sometimes going back a long way too, right? So it's like if I just talk about something sad that happened 10 years ago and I can like really remember it, then I can also remember how it feels, and I'll start crying just remembering it. But I can also remember joy pretty well too, which is nice. And so I have a really deep, I describe it pretty much as a physical ability to remember my feelings in a variety of situations. Like if I can remember the situation, I can usually remember how I felt in it pretty accurately. And this is a huge part of why I like writing erotica, because erotica is mostly about how people feel, and I'm very good at remembering how I felt in a sexual situation. And so I can write, and also I just remember the world, the world in words, because I don't remember what anything looks and so that allows me to write erotica relatively easily. But the reason why this had come up with reference to kink was someone was like, "How in the hell, as someone with aphantasia, did you learn to tie?" And I said, "Yeah, that's a solid question, and why I often joke, if I can learn to tie, anybody can learn to tie, because I had so many disadvantages in learning to tie. It is ridiculously hard. I'm not gonna lie. If you were also someone without if with if you were also someone with aphantasia out there listening to this, and you're like, I could never learn to tie. The reality is that you have to rely on everything else in order to be able to do it, and you also have to be really honest with yourself about what your limitations are. So, I learned to tie by repetition, so I have, pretty decent kinesthetic memory, thank goodness. It's not fantastic by any means, but it's okay. I cannot, as I mentioned, rotate 3D objects in my head, so I have to just sort of memorize how to do lots of things and talk myself through it. I really have to talk myself through certain steps, especially as I was beginning, but mostly I just memorized as I was starting out lots of instructions. So I would try to break everything down as much as I could into words. I found for myself having videos was tremendously helpful because I could just watch them over and over again. Shibari studies are really great for that because they show you multiple angles, which also helped me because I, again, can't rotate the object in my head, so I don't understand what it looks like at a different angle. And I really relied heavily on those videos because the videos wouldn't get impatient with me for asking to see something again and again. And I just started narrating a lot to myself. I think the only reason I was able to learn to tie was I was very devoted to doing so. It was really hard. And to this day, especially if I'm doing like any type of photo rope thing, where I need somebody to be in a pose, I always end up asking my bottom to help me, in order to be able to make sure that I'm doing it right. I have to think through some things really hard in order to be able to do it. I will say it's a cruel thing to do to myself. It is probably of all the things I do in my life, the thing that makes me feel like I have a disability in terms of aphantasia. Obviously, there's certain types of other work that I could do that would also where aphantasia would be a disability. But I picked a kink where it's really, really hard. When I'm rope bottoming, it doesn't much matter, but if I'm tying, it matters a great deal. And so I ask my bottoms for help. Sometimes I have to draw things out ahead of time to make sure that I have a general idea about what it is that I'm going to do. But the biggest thing was just learning to break things down into words, which is, how I mostly process the world anyway. And so I'm pretty used to doing that. And if you are somebody who also has aphantasia and want to learn to tie, that's pretty much what I would recommend is trying to seek it out in terms of words, right? And as much as you can, getting memory into your hands and into your body. So that's some information and a lot of opinions on the way that kink and neurodivergence interact. I wish that I had more information on the way that poly and neurodivergence interact. As I said, don't really have much at all in the way of data on these things, but I do have a lot of data now on queer and, if not neurodivergence, at least the thing that's right next to it in mental health. And I will definitely talk more about that in a later episode. And thank you for listening.